Well, this morning we are going to be looking at one of the great texts of Scripture. Some people claim it's great because there's quite a controversy within it, but controversy is not the basis for making something great. It's great because it gives a very clear description of the spiritual blindness of man and God's great mercy to give man the truth. It's great because it's a text that centers on God's ability to use people who will yield themselves to him. Turn with me over to Matthew chapter 16. We're going to be looking at verses 13 through 20. The parallel passages are in Mark 8 and in Luke 9, but both of those are very brief and only add a little bit of incidental information to our understanding of what occurs, so our focus is going to be here in Matthew this morning. Please follow along as I read, and then we're going to go back and look at it verse by verse. That way we will see the hand of God at work. We will also be able to deal with the controversy and resolve that. My hope is that by the time you leave today, you should both understand this passage and understand how God can use you. Matthew chapter 16, verse 13. Now when Jesus came into the district of Caesarea Philippi, he was asking his disciples, "Who do people say that the Son of Man is?" And they said, "Some say John the Baptist, and others Elijah, but still others Jeremiah or one of the prophets." He said to them, "But who do you say that I am?" Simon Peter answered, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." And Jesus said to him, "Blessed are you, Simon Barjona, because flesh and blood did not reveal this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. I also say that you are Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades will not overpower it. I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and whatever you bind on earth shall be bound in heaven. Whatever you loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven." And then he warned the disciples they should tell no one that he was the Christ. Now this passage takes place in what is sometimes referred to as the withdrawal period of Jesus' ministry. Ever since the 12 had come back from their first ministry assignment, they went out teaching, preaching, and healing throughout the land of Galilee. They had finally come back. And then John the Baptist had been executed by Herod at that time as well. Ever since that point in time, Jesus continually is withdrawing from the crowds, but he can't seem to get away with them because another crowd will form. You'll recall first he left Capernaum and went to a lonely place near Bethsaida. And there a large crowd formed because they followed him from Capernaum. And he ministered to them and ended up feeding over 5,000 with just 5 barley loaves and 2 fish. Next, he and the disciples, they traveled across the sea. Actually, Jesus met them in the middle of the sea in a windstorm. Then they went to the agricultural area of Gennesaret. Fewer people, maybe it'll be peaceful there. Instead, the people there find him, send word out, and he ends up ministering there. From there, he went back up to Capernaum and was speaking in the synagogue. The crowd that had been over in Bethsaida finds him there, and now he's got a large crowd again. Again, he ministers to them. But at this time, as he's teaching them, they find that his teaching is too difficult for them, and they left him. Jesus then ended up with a strong controversy with the Pharisees and the scribes and rebuked them because they held their traditions to be superior to the actual commandments of the law. Jesus and the 12 next decide to go way north up into a Gentile area of Sidon in the region of Tyre. And even there, though he is not as known, a Gentile woman finds out about him and comes begging that he would cast a demon out of her daughter, which Jesus did, even though she was a Gentile. Jesus' disciples then traveled back down south, here again to a Gentile area on the southeast shore of the Sea of Galilee in what's called Decapolis. But after a couple of days, again, there is a large multitude, and he ministers to them. There he feeds over 4,000 with 7 loaves and a few small fish. Next, he decides to sail away from there, and he goes to Magadan, which is on the opposite side of the Sea of Galilee. But as soon as he lands, there ends up quickly developing a conflict with the Pharisees and the Sadducees. So the disciples and he get in a boat. They sail again to Bethsaida. And in Bethsaida, as we talked about last week, he healed a man who was blind and deaf. He was able to see and then to speak. And then today we find his disciples have left Bethsaida. They're traveling north again up to the region of Caesarea Philippi. Now that area is actually, it's a very beautiful area. It's on the slopes of Mount Hermon. Mount Hermon is often snow-covered. It rises 9,232 feet. It's one of the sources of the Jordan River. And there on the slopes somewhere, in the villages near Caesarea Philippi, we come to what's happening in our text today. Jesus has stopped somewhere, and according to Luke, he has spent some time praying by himself. And after that time of prayer, he then asks this question to his disciples. Who do people say that the Son of Man is? Now, Jesus is not interested in gossip. He's not interested in statements from foolish people. He is not interested in the opinions of the religious leaders. They've already given their opinion. Caused a lot of conflict. They said his power came from Satan. Jesus wants a report from the disciples about what they're hearing from the common people. What are they saying about me? Are they understanding the ministry that I have been performing in front of them? Do they understand the teaching that I've been giving them? Do they understand who I am? Who do the people say that I am? Now, the disciples respond that people had a lot of different opinions. Some said Jesus was John the Baptist. Well, I guess that makes some sense because Jesus was obviously somebody special, and John the Baptist is one of the special people that they had seen recently. In fact, Herod's advisors told Herod that's who Jesus was. But they were ignorant of the fact that John and Jesus were contemporaries and that John had baptized Jesus. Others, agreeing that Jesus is special, said he's Elijah. That's based on Malachi 4:5, which alludes to the fact that Elijah would come back before the Messiah. But problem was is that Jesus had already had said that John the Baptist had fulfilled that role. He was not Elijah. Others said he was Jeremiah the prophet, and that one's like, what? Jeremiah the prophet? Well, that's based on a tradition. This tradition, it was that Jeremiah had taken the Ark of the Covenant and the altar of incense out of the temple prior to the destruction by the and looting by the Babylonians, and he hid them somewhere on Mount Nebo. As the tradition goes on, it is that Jeremiah is going to return and get those things and return them to Jerusalem when or just prior to the Messiah's return. He'll put them back in the proper place in the temple. But the people were ignorant. There was no basis in Scripture for this tradition, and it simply was not true. Then there are the rest of the people. At least they're honest enough that they don't know who he is, and they admit it. A prophet of some sort? Maybe a prophet. One of the other prophets have come back. They didn't know. They were confused. At least they were honest about it. Now notice that all these ideas incorporate them believing that there is something different about Jesus. There is something special about him. How could they not believe that considering all the many miracles he has done? He is somebody special, but who? But who? None of them accept the fact that Jesus was who he claimed to be. The bread come down from heaven, the promised Messiah. The signs, the wonders that Jesus did fulfilled the prophecies that he is the Messiah, but even the miracles still did not convince them of that fact. Now that's the same thing going on today. If you go out on the streets and start asking, what do you think about Jesus? Who do you think he is? You'll get all sorts of answers. Philosophers will say he was a very wise, great teacher. Ethicists, he's a great moral example. Liberal religionists say, well, he provided a model of how we should live. Even atheists will proclaim, well, he was among the greatest of the sons of men. He was a great man. Rock stars have sung that Jesus Christ is a superstar, whatever that is. But in every case, though there's a claim, the proclamation, the pronouncements about him, what they believe is far, far below who he is. We've got to keep in mind that the God of this age has blinded the mind of the unbelieving. It is true today as it was then. In Jesus' time, these people were firsthand witnesses. They saw miracle after miracle. They were present. They heard him teach. They experienced his love and his compassion in ways that make us marvel. And yet, they did not recognize his true identity. And once his teachings became difficult, they turned away from him. Now keep that in mind as you evangelize. This is something that's going to have to be in God's hands because people are going to respond the same way. You're going to be telling them directly, and it's just like they just don't get it. Keep in mind as well that there are those who are advocating what's called power evangelism. This is the idea that, well, if we could present the gospel and it was accompanied with a miracle, people would turn to Christ. No, they won't. Jesus Christ himself did the miracles. He was doing the teachings. And what did they do? Well, he's John the Baptist. He's Elijah. Jeremiah. Some unknown. They didn't believe it when Christ was telling them and doing it in front of them. You think that's going to happen now? It's not. People are the same. People do not believe because of a lack of miracles. They do not believe because their minds are blinded to the truth and their hearts are dead in trespasses and sin. And as the next three verses will show, people believe because God works in their heart. Now, Jesus wanted to know what the people were thinking, but even more, he wanted to know what were the disciples thinking by this time. And so he makes the question more personal there in verse 15. Who do you say that I am? Actually, the emphasis here is on the you. Who do you say that I am? And it's plural. It's to all the disciples. What do you believe about me? Remember, salvation's a personal affair. What other people believe is insignificant. It doesn't matter. Because when you stand before God, you will be alone unless Jesus Christ is your advocate. And it's good to have your lawyer with you, isn't it? 1 John 2:1 describes him with that. But judgment is going to be made first about what you believe about Jesus Christ, whether you do or do not. If your belief is in him, your name is written in the Lamb's Book of Life, you're going to go to heaven. If you do not believe in him, your name is not there, then you're going to be judged a second time, this time on the very basis of your works. What have you done? And they will condemn you. What do you believe about Jesus? Simon Peter answers, and it's important to point out here, he is answering on behalf of all the disciples. And he says this, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." He's direct. He has understood that Jesus is the Christ. Remember that Christ equals Messiah. Both mean the anointed one. He is the one promised of old who would come to redeem man from their sins. Peter also uses the articles to make Jesus' deity clear here. In fact, a full wooden translation of this would be as, "You are the Christ, the Son of the God, the living one." He is not a God or a son of a God as would be in the Greek pantheon. He's not related to some dead idol. He is the Son of the God who is the self-existent living one. And while the 12 do not fully understand all of what Jesus is, there's still much that Jesus is going to teach them, much they're going to experience. They have finally come to the point where they do understand this, that Jesus is one in essence with God the Father, because a Son is one in nature with the Father. Now, Peter and the other disciples are not any more intelligent than anybody else. Yes, they have an advantage. They are in close proximity to Jesus, but they also have some of the same questions the rest of the multitudes. Why hasn't Jesus gotten rid of these scribes and Pharisees that are making a mockery of the temple? He scourged them, but they're back. Why hasn't he switched out the high priest and put some real people in there that actually love God? Why hasn't he overthrown Rome? We're looking for Messiah to come and set up a political kingdom and reign from David's throne. Why hasn't this happened? They have those same questions. And yes, in proximity, they can see Jesus doing miracle after miracle. They can hear his teaching. They see his actions day in, day out. But the public also saw those things. Jesus didn't do these things in a closet. He did them publicly. The miracles were out there for everybody to see. He taught publicly. His compassion was there publicly as he healed people. The truth about Christ was known to, or at least available to be known to everybody. Verse 17 points out the real difference as he commends Peter. Jesus answered and said to him, "Blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah, because flesh and blood did not reveal this to you, but my Father who is in heaven." Human wisdom cannot understand the things of God because, as 1 Corinthians 2:14 states, a natural man does not accept the things of the Spirit of God, for they are foolishness to him. And he cannot understand them because they're spiritually appraised. This is the problem man has. He refuses to believe what is explained clearly in front of him. It's foolish to him, and so he rejects it. Jesus had said earlier in Matthew 11:27, "All things have been handed over to me by the Father, and no one knows the Son except the Father, nor does anyone know the Father except the Son, and anyone to whom the Son wills to reveal him." So Jesus is telling Peter that Simon Bar-Jonah, the son of Jonah, he had an earthly father, but he did not come to understand that Jesus was the Christ by anything arising out of humanity. It's because Jesus' Father, who's in heaven, revealed it to Simon. And for that reason, and for that reason only, Peter was blessed. And so it is for all those for whom the Father has chosen to reveal the Son. Remember, salvation does not come by any human means or method. You can't earn it. Human wisdom, again, it's foolishness before God, 1 Corinthians 13:19. And yet we have many who think somehow they're going to get there on their own. They're going to work their way somehow. It isn't going to happen. Even man's self-efforts to do something righteous never will meet the standard of a holy and righteous God. That's why Isaiah 64:6 says they're filthy rags. Our efforts to be righteous are as filthy rags before him. That's how holy he is. Salvation comes to those who respond to the revelation that God gives them concerning himself and his Son. It comes to those who seek out God's wisdom rather than human wisdom. Those who seek for God's righteousness rather than self-righteousness. Who seek God's mercy and grace and forgiveness of sins rather than trying to put themselves in a position where they can demand favors from God. Salvation from sin comes by God's grace alone, through faith alone, in Jesus Christ alone, and no other way. Now, Jesus made his question personal to disciples. Let me make it personal to you. Who do you say that Jesus is? What do you believe about him? Good moral example. Great thinker, model of life, good teacher, superstar. Those are nice, but do you believe what he himself claims about himself? Are you willing to declare what Peter does? He is the Christ, the Messiah, the anointed one, who has fulfilled all the prophecies from the Old Testament, who is the Son of the living God. And take to heart, there is a warning as well. You can claim anything you want, that doesn't make it true. What you actually believe will come out in how you live. Why? Because the actions that you have in life arise out of what you believe. So the manner in which you live your life is going to declare to everyone what you really believe about Christ. What do you really believe? Who do you say that Jesus is? Now, Jesus' commendation of Peter continues in verse 18. In verse 18, it's become the point of a lot of debate. It's really not that difficult to understand if it will be kept in context, but This is one of those passages most people rip it out of context and bring other things to bear upon it. Jesus says, and remember he's talking to Peter at this point, "And I say to you that you are Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church." Now, in the previous sentence, Jesus had called Peter by his given name, which is Simon Barjona. Again, Bar means son of, so Simon, son of Jonah. In the next sentence, Jesus calls him by the name we most commonly refer to him as Peter. It's from Petros. Petros means isolated rock or stone. Jesus then added, upon this rock, and the word rock there is Petra, not Petros, Petra, which means large bedrock or large rock. And he says, I will build my church. The question then becomes, to whom or what does this rock refer to? What is this rock? Now, some have tried to get rid of the controversy by simply saying that, well, the phrase was incorrectly out of the text. Problem is that all manuscripts going back, all families of manuscripts, Alexandrian, Vatican, Western, Byzantine, all those text types, whether late or early, all have the verse. It's arrogant ignorance that tries to take away what is in the text of the Scriptures, and worse here, because they're taken away simply because they don't want to deal with it. It's in the text. You have to deal with it. Now, the Roman Catholic Church has used verses 18 and 19 to claim that Peter is the first pope. Their reasoning is that in these verses, Peter is given a first place of honor. He's given authority within the church, and that every successive pope has received that same honor and power. And so it also claims, because of that, that all true followers of Christ must be in submission to the Church of Rome, where Peter rules in the person of his successor, whoever the current pope is. Now, such an argument is absurd on its face, but even more so as you deal with the details of this. Number one, the authority that is given to Peter in verse 19 to bind and loose was given to all the apostles in Matthew 18, 18. So it's not just to Peter alone that gets this. Second, Peter never claimed, nor do any of the other apostles give Peter such a place of prominence or authority in the church. In fact, Peter's own terms for himself, 1 Peter 5:1, is he was a fellow elder, as he is writing to elders of churches and encouraging them. 2 Peter 1:1, he describes himself as a bondservant, a doulos, a slave. He didn't take on those kinds of ideas of somehow being superior above all other Christians. Third, every opportunity in which Peter's supposed supremacy could have been reinforced by Jesus or by Peter himself or by any of the other apostles, it was not. He is prominent among the apostles, but he has no supremacy over them. And fourth, neither in this passage or in any other passage is there any evidence for apostolic succession by which any supposed superiority Peter had is transferred to anyone else. To put it simply, the Roman Catholic Church interpretation of this passage is without biblical support. And in fact, it is contrary to the Scriptures. Jesus Christ is both the foundation and the only head of the church. 1 Corinthians 3:11, Colossians 1, and there's many other passages that deal with that. Christ, not Peter, is the head of the church. Now, others have reacted to the Roman Catholic interpretation, and so they try to remove the man Peter from being in any way referenced by this phrase, this rock. Now, biblical interpretation founded upon a reaction to somebody else's error is never a good basis for interpretation either. Who or what, then, is the rock referring to if it is not Peter? Now, much has been made over the differences between these two Greek words. The name Peter, again, is Petros. Petros. P-E-T-R-O-S in English. And the word can mean isolated rock or stone in the common Greek. The word rock here is Petra, ends in an A, P-E-T-R-A. And in common Greek, it means large stone, bedrock, rocky ledge. Cliff face. This difference is then used to build a case that the rock is either Peter's confession in verse 16, or it is Jesus himself, the Son of the living God, that Jesus is. Now, part of that is because 1 Corinthians 10:4 says that Jesus is the spiritual rock that followed Israel. They try and tie these together. Now, that's interesting, but we end up with a problem as we dig into this. Now, the word Petra is used throughout the New Testament in a literal sense. It's used for bedrock. It's used for rock ledge. It's used for cliff face. It's also used figuratively, as it is in this passage. However, the word Petros, though in common Greek it can refer to a stone or a smaller rock, actually can even refer to like a pebble, its only usage in the New Testament is for Simon's nickname, Peter, which I will point out from John 1:42 is a translation of Peter's Aramaic nickname, Cephas. Cephas and Peter mean exactly the same thing. As you study further in this and you look up, well, what word is used for a small stone in that, consistently throughout the New Testament is the word lithos. That refers to a smaller rock or a stone. That means making an interpretation based on difference between Petros and Petra, based on the common Greek, is tenuous at best. So let's go back to the context. The context of this passage points to something actually fairly simple. It explains the word differences and what Jesus is talking about. In the Greek, nouns have gender, feminine, masculine, or neuter. And every gender has a form on how that word ends. It's similar in a lot of other languages. Those of you who speak Spanish, you're familiar with that. The word ending is key to figuring out a lot of things about the word itself, right? Same in Greek. The word for rock, Petra, is feminine. It's a feminine gender noun. If you wanted to use that term and apply it to a man, you have to change the ending. Otherwise, it really isn't too good to call a man by a feminine name. Okay? You're going to change it to the masculine form, otherwise there's lots of confusion. So simply changing from Petra, referring to the rock, to Petros, referring to Peter, is changing the gender, so you can use it in that fashion. Even in Greek, Jesus is saying this, you are rock, which is actually what, again, Jesus called him back in when he first met him. You are Cephas, you are rock. You are rock, and on this rock I will build my church. Hendrickson points out in his commentary that the word this rock makes reference to anything other than the immediately preceding Petros, Peter, very, very unnatural. You'd have to have something pushing you to force that. The rock referred to here is Peter. Jesus is promising to build his church on him. But not Peter as the primary foundation, or Peter all by himself, or Peter in his natural state. It would be Peter as a man who is the product of God's grace. Peter as the first among equals as an apostle. Peter as a main stone laid on the primary foundation, which is Jesus Christ himself. As Paul said in 1 Corinthians 3:11, other foundation can no man lay than is laid, which is Jesus Christ. Ephesians 2:20 explains that the apostles were a foundational in a secondary sense. It says the church is built upon the foundation of the apostles and prophets, Jesus Christ himself being the chief cornerstone. So the prophets were important, but secondary to Christ himself. Historically, we look back and we find that Peter was the primary character in the early chapters of Acts. He is the primary spokesman for the rest of the apostles. He is the principal preacher. Much of the apostles' doctrine in the early church in Acts 2:42 that it was devoting itself had come through Peter. History has proven Jesus' words. The church was built upon Peter, but Peter was not a pope. Peter never held authority over any of the other apostles. In fact, in Acts 15, This is the Council of Jerusalem. When judgment is made, it's made by the apostles and elders, both plural. And the leader of that council is not Peter. Peter spoke at it, but the leader of it is James. Peter is no pope. He is the rock, but no pope. And Peter, being the rock, gives no support to Roman Catholic papacy. Now look again at verse 18, because this controversy usually ends up washing over what the point of the verse is. What is being emphasized in the verse? The actual emphasis is not on the rock. It is on the church and its builder. The action of the verse is building the church. The one that performs the act of the building is Jesus Christ. Peter and the church are nothing without Jesus. Perhaps that's why there are so many churches around now that are nothing, because they've left this Christ, the scriptures, outside the doors. Without Christ, the church is nothing. We'll expand on that topic in the future, but let me emphasize this here. Jesus builds the church, ecclesia, called out assembly of the saints. It's not Peter, it's not the apostles, it's not any denomination, it's not pastors, it's not you. Does Jesus use people I've mentioned? Certainly he does. Of course he does. In fact, the church could not be built without them. But we are simply the materials by which Jesus builds his church. Our value only becomes apparent as Jesus uses us. Now, currently we're sitting inside a physical building. Think a moment about what makes up this building. There's wood, there's concrete, there's brick, there's block, there's plaster, there's metal of various sorts, there's fabrics. How valuable are any of these things apart from the builder using it specifically for its particular purpose? The wood in this structure could have been used for firewood. Could have been used in some other structure. Instead, it was size, shape, cut, and it made truss beams. It made wall framing. It made furniture, such as this pulpit or the communion table. The materials that make up the concrete in this building could have been left in the ground. Instead, it was mined, manufactured, mixed, and then poured into a particular place for a particular function, including the foundation, the floor down below, and the cinder blocks that make up the first floor, and holding it all together. That same concrete could have been poured someplace else, but it was used here. The same is true for the metals that make up the nails and the screws and the plates and all the electric wiring. Or the fabrics could have been made all sorts of things. Instead, it was used to make carpeting and cover the chairs and make draperies. All these things are simply materials used by a builder to manufacture and produce something that is worthwhile, that has a purpose, that is can complete a task. Jesus was useful to Peter was useful to Jesus as a rock because he yielded himself to be used as Jesus saw fit. In his case, it was a foundation stone on which other parts of the church would be built. But each and every brick has a part, does it not, in a building? Maybe that's why Peter uses the building analogy. Over in 1 Peter chapter 2, Peter describes each individual coming to Jesus. And then it says, quote, as a living stone, this is 1 Peter 2:4, coming as a living stone, rejected by men, but choice and precious in the sight of God, you also, as living stones, are being built up as a spiritual house for a holy priesthood to offer up spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ. It is Jesus that does the building. Now, Acts records a lot about the activities of Peter and the other apostles. But how was the church built in Acts? Acts 2, verse 47 states, and the Lord was adding to their number day by day those who were being saved. Who built the church? Jesus did. How'd he do it? By using people. And yes, that included Peter preaching and the other apostles preaching and all the other things that went on, the evangelism that went on and the spreading the gospel into both into Samaria and then down in the Gentile areas and then out to the othermost parts of the world. He used people, but Jesus built the church. Are you ready and willing to be a brick, piece of wood, a yard of fabric, whatever else the Lord needs as he is building the church as he sees fit? Because if you are, then Jesus will use you. He'll be part of the church he is building. Now, the Lord describes an additional characteristic about the church he is building at the end of verse 18. Now, let's face it. There are some buildings you would love to be part of, and others, that's okay. Skip it. I don't want to be part of that. So let's talk about what is the church. What is this building he's putting together? What are its characteristics? This is marvelous. The strength of this, of the church. End of verse 18, it says, "The gates of Hades shall not overpower it." He is building a church that is so strong it is not limited by any outside factors. Now, many have referred to this and think it's a reference to the church withstanding the attacks of the devil. That, unfortunately, is because of a wrong translation that appears in some English texts. The word here is not hell, it's Hades, and there's a difference between the two. Hades corresponds to the Old Testament Sheol. It's the abode of the dead. In fact, here, the gates of Hades refers to death. It's equivalent of that same phrase, gates of death, that is used in Psalm 9, verse 13 and 107:18. So it's not uncommon in Scripture to have that, the gates of death. Now, what does it mean that the gates of Hades will not prevail against the church? Gates signify a boundary of authority. Generally, it contains what's in it, and it also the boundary to keep out what's outside of it. That's what gates do. Keep within, keep out. Okay? You shut your gate, and you keep your dog in, and you also keep the other stray dogs out. Right? Gates. Now, generally, a gate is not a weapon of offense, right? You don't have people going out into battle. Think about that, soldiers. Two soldiers each had the right gate and the left gate, and they walk out into battle with their gates. Beware, I've got my gates, right? Bang, bang, you dropped your gates, that's over with, right? Gates are not a weapon of offense. So it's important here, this is gates of Hades, it's gates of death. How can that be offensive? It's because death is. Death draws all men within its gates. You may not want to go, you're still going. Death draws all men within its gate, within its power, within its authority, and subdues them. And we go to the grave. Hence the idea here why Jesus would say this. The gates of Hades, the gates of death, will not overpower, will not prevail against the church. Now the reality is that death does overpower all people. It ends the constructions of our lives. And even what we leave behind, well, it'll corrode and decay. If you're a builder, and you're building a building, and you die before you complete it, your project dies with you. If you manage to complete the building, give it some time and it's going to corrode and collapse. It falls down. The house my dad had helped construct after World War II, when we were down in Mississippi a couple years ago, it's now collapsed. We went inside, the floor is rotting out. My cousin's supposed to burn it. I hope he does soon because it's really horrible to go and see a place. I remember as a kid having so much fun with my grandparents and cousins, and it's dilapidated. It's falling down. Death brings about destruction. Think about any kind of movement. You have leaders. They get a movement started. What happens as soon as they die? Well, whoever the new leaders are going to take it where they want to go. Whatever ideas they had may or may not even hold sway. It'll change direction. death even ends movements. Death brings an end to men and their efforts. If the church was built by the efforts of men, it would have died with the apostles. Or it would have died with the church leaders that corrupted her institutions in the generations that followed them. And though the church is built with people, death does not overpower the church because our master builder conquered death and he lives forevermore. The builder's still there. Jesus' death paid the price for sin. He made the church possible by redeeming man and enabling him to be forgiven and then adopted into God's family. Jesus' resurrection proves his claims and his promises, and it makes death a vanquished enemy. In the present, Jesus intercedes for his followers, and the Holy Spirit indwells and empowers true Christians to follow and serve the Lord. In addition, he has left us his word, which is described in Hebrews as living. It changes us. And even though the church in every generation is swallowed up by death in the sense that those who were in it, those leaders, they've been swallowed up by death, every new generation has new leaders within it. God raises them up. Even when church leaders prove to be false and they corrupt the institutions that used to be there, new institutions are brought up and the church continues. Those of us with gray hair, we can cite you specific examples of institutions that were strong when we were young, you want nothing to do with now because they're not following Christ. And yet, new groups have formed, new churches have formed, new Bible colleges have formed, new seminaries have formed. Jesus Christ is alive. He continues to build his church despite death removing the generation prior and despite the corruption of man. The architect and builder is still around, so he continues to build. Death cannot overpower the church that Jesus is building. Verse 19, Jesus says to Peter, I will give you the keys, the kingdom of heaven. Whatever you bind on earth shall have been bound in heaven. Whatever you loose on earth shall have been loosed in heaven. We're going to be looking at this again in Matthew 18, so I'm going to spend a lot more time with that there. But I need to point out here, Jesus is specifically speaking to Peter. But Peter, even in this passage, is representative of all the apostles. He's speaking on their behalf. In Matthew 18:18, Jesus specifically says the same thing to all the apostles. So whatever it means for Peter to have the keys of the kingdom, the ability to bind and loose, it applies to all apostles. So it's not specifically Peter or Peter alone. Well, first, what are this idea of keys of the kingdom? When we look at other passages that have this idea of keys, it indicates that this is referring to the power to admit or refuse a person into heaven. Now, how is such a thing done? How do we either admit or refuse someone into heaven? Well, it's actually very simple, and all of you can do it. It's the gospel. As you're preaching the gospel and the Lord opens a person's heart to understand and receive it, they're admitted. The gospel is the key to admit someone into the kingdom, as the Lord would work on that person's heart. At the same time, the gospel is also a key that shuts the kingdom against those who refuse to believe. This is actually talked about in Acts 3:23. The gospel is preached, but they refuse to believe it. The door is shut and locked. They're not coming in. The truth was handed to them. They rejected it. Nothing else could be done. So the keys, the kingdom is the gospel. It opens and shuts the doors to heaven. Now, the issue of binding and loosing here has absolutely nothing to do with Satan and demons. Absolutely nothing. Notice that this is whatever, not whoever, dealing with not people or entities or angelic beings. Binding and loosing is a rabbinic term, and it refers to forbid or permit. It's an issue of the church being able to discipline those within it, which is going to become more clear when we get to Matthew 18 and its context. Jesus told his disciples shortly after his resurrection, John 20, verse 23, if you forgive the sins of any, their sins have been forgiven them. If you retain the sins of any, they've been retained. That's what this is referring to. Peter and later the other apostles and the church are given the authority to examine a person's life in light of the Scriptures and determine whether they are in sin or not, and whether they are repentant or not. The judgment is not arbitrary. It's based upon the Scriptures themselves, and we'll cover that in detail in Matthew 18. But keep that in mind. The church has the authority to discipline those that profess to be Christians. It can bind or loose. And then Jesus closes this discussion with disciples, warning them, don't tell anyone he's the Christ. Why? Well, we already could see what the people are believing. They're looking for a political kingdom. They're not willing to recognize yet who Jesus is. The kingdom is there, it's present, but they're not willing to recognize it. And Jesus himself will announce the Messiah at the proper time in keeping with God's plan for salvation, but it was not yet that time. But we end with this. Who is Jesus to you? That was the question that started all this off. Well, who do the people say? But it's got to come down to something personal. Who is he to you? Doesn't matter what your friends think. It doesn't matter what your siblings think or your parents think. Who is he to you? And the second question, if you do understand that he is the Christ, the Son of the living God, and you believe in him and you want to follow him, are you ready and willing to be used by him however he desires? You see, if you desire that you have to have some particular place, you're in trouble. I often find that God doesn't do that. He wants us to be humble. We want some place here, there, or someplace else because we think we know what's best. The builder knows what's best. He knows exactly where you're going to fit best and how you will glorify him as he builds his church. Are you willing and ready to do that? Because if you are, I can guarantee you, he will do that. And he will use you for eternal purposes, much beyond the short lives we live here. Something that's worth living for. And all you have to do is step out in faith to serve him. Father, thank you for your blessings to us. Thank you for the truth of this word. Thank you that we can trust you in all things. Father, thank you that it's not based on our intelligence, our wisdom, but Father, it's your grace and mercy extended to us that we can even understand who Christ is. Father, for those here today that have yet to bow their knee to Christ, that even today would be the day of salvation, that in your mercy, you'd bring them to a knowledge of this great truth, and they'd follow you. Father, thank you as well that you use us as part of your church, part of this building that is made for your glory, a building made of people. Father, that's not about our ability and talents. It's about you simply using us as you see fit. Thank you for wherever you have put us, that we, the one worthy of anything, can be used for your glory. And Father, all of it because of what Christ has done for us. In Jesus' name, amen.